Well, I think it's obvious that we love to talk about soil conservation practices here on this show, but it's always important to frame it in a realistic context that acknowledges farms are businesses, risky businesses. So the right thing for the soil has to also be the right thing for a farm's profitability.
We've also found that we continue to be profitable in the same way that we were before using these other practices. And that's really the point we try and get across to the farmers we talk to, is that, you know, profitability is not this one and conservation this one. I said they can be very close together. It's not like they're two ends of a spectrum. Some of it isn't that I'm getting a greater yield. It's just I have fewer costs related to the tillage that I was doing prior to that.
Michigan farmer Lori Isley shares how they've embraced new practices at Sunrise Farms, from strip tillage to precision technology to biologicals and beyond, on today's episode of Soil Sense. This is the Soil Sense podcast, where we believe that building healthier soils is not just a prescription, but rather a pursuit. On this show, we unpack the ways farmers collaborate to build healthier soils and adapt systems to work on their farm for both sustainability and profitability. Let's get to the root of all that and cover some ground on today's episode of Soil Sense. Hey there, welcome back to Soil Sense. I'm one of your hosts, Tim Hammerich. Joining me, of course, is our co-host, Dr. Abby Wick, and we're sitting down today with Michigan farmer Lori Isley. Lori is one of the owners of Sunrise Farms, located in southeastern Michigan. Along with her husband, Jim, and their son, Jacob, they farm about 1,100 acres of corn and soybeans and implement a variety of different conservation practices that we'll talk about, including strip tillage, cover crops that they have flown on, filter strips, soil tests, and precision ag practices. Lori, who in addition to farming, spent decades teaching agriscience at the high school level, also now contributes to the industry as part of the Michigan Soybean Committee and the United Soybean Board, where she is the chair of the Communication and Education Committee. She kicks off our conversation today talking briefly about the soil in her area of southeastern Michigan and how their journey into soil health got kicked into overdrive.
We were once part of the Black Swamp, as they referred to it back then, many, many centuries ago. This was part of Lake Erie. And so we are very, very flat in this area, and we have brady, sandy loam soils. And we actually began to implement a lot of our conservation practices so that we kept the soil that we had on the ground. So one of the very first things we did was put up windbreaks, and that was generations ago. And then once we began to look at some of the other opportunities that were out there, we began to implement more and more of them. We started cover crops probably about 8 years ago, primarily by looking at our soil and just noticing that it had very little tilth to it. I mean, it just did not have the structure that we wanted to see it have. That was also concurrent with Jacob coming back from college, because people come back with agronomy degrees. They have all sorts of new ideas. Thankfully, we were pretty open to listening to what he had learned there. So we were able to implement many of those practices. A few years after that, we thought, okay, we still think maybe there's too much disruption or disturbance to our soil. So then we implemented both strip tillage for our corn, as well as very, very minimum or no-till for soybeans, and put in filter strips and some water retention systems and several different things. But probably one of the most important ones is just we try and collect a significant amount of data. We soil test half of our acres every other year, so we have a lot of data on soil nutrient levels. And then we also use a lot of technology in our planter, sprayer, and combine, just so we have information to make good decisions, so we're not over applying nutrients, but we're also being able to specifically look at where those nutrients are applied. So if we have a sandy hill, we put less on, that's not going to yield better no matter what we do to it. So instead of using those there, we do that. But we feel pretty good about the program, you might say, that we have in place now, but we're always looking for new ideas. And our slogan is kind of, you don't know what you don't know. So the more information, the more data we have, the better decisions we can make.
Yeah, I'm curious to tie in some of this education into the conservation practices. What were some of those ideas that Jacob brought back from school that you started implementing on your farm?
Well, a lot of it was probably soil health related, without question. You know, how important our soil is and how what it has, the components of it, how they can over time, you know, impact the quality of your crop. So farmers have to be productive and we have to be profitable. So whatever we implement has to be able to pay off in that. Sometimes with conservation, that's harder to see. And we've done several seminars at our farm here. Jim likes to talk conservation about as well as I do. So he's part of a farmer-led advisory group for the River Raisin Watershed. That's the watershed that we're in. And so we've had several meetings here in the shop to bring people in, to show them the strip till, to explain to them what it is that we do. We'll dig a hole in the field and try and show them, you know, how the organic matter, how we've seen increases in both the earthworms, other microorganisms, and just the structure of the soil itself. It's pretty hard, as I'm sure you know, to measure carbon in your soil. So I can't tell you that we've seen a tremendous increase in that. We think that there are other improvements that have come from implementing those practices. And so we've tried to share those. But a lot of what he came back with were just, okay, we need to have a better structure to our soil in order for it to do what it's going to do. We need to reduce our tillage that we use, and we need to start looking at practices we can put in place that will help us to work more efficiently.
And you said you had started the cover crops 8 years ago. So I think that's before Jacob came back, right?
Or just about the time that he did. And there was some push there because we're in the Lake Erie watershed. I remember there was a time where they had to shut off the water to Toledo, made a really big impact to a lot of people. For about 3 days, they were without water because of the algal bloom in Lake Erie. The algal bloom, they traced back to an excess of phosphorus. And then they very soon after that pointed a finger at the farmers and said, it's your fault. And we recognize now that it's not entirely the farmer's fault, but we, nor can we step back and say we have nothing to do with this problem because we are part of that situation. So some of the money, the government began to say, okay, we've got to do something about this. We're going to start putting some money there. So some of it was funds available to try that new practice. And so we took advantage of that early on. And then we just saw that there were benefits. A lot of those benefits, again, were just in keeping our soil in place. We really try and have a crop on the ground 12 months out of the year. Now we fly that cover crop on. We have it flown on. We don't fly it. We have it flown on into the standing corn and soybeans. They get harvested. It's already started. Then we terminate it in the spring. And then we plant right into the recently terminated cover crop so that there's another crop growing. Sometimes there are challenges with that this year because we had a really, really dry spring. If the cover crop was still growing, it was pulling moisture that we would have really liked to have seen go to the soybeans and the corn instead of the cover crop. But areas where it had been heavy, which is a bit of some of the concern when you have it flowing on, it's not quite as even, but it still works really well. So those are some of the things that we had to kind of balance out as we were making some of those decisions.
What cover crops are you flying on? And here in North Dakota, cereal rye is the only thing that survives the winter. So I'm imagining it's a little bit different in Michigan, or maybe you're using rye as your primary tool.
Annual ryegrass is our primary tool. We do mix some vetch into it as well. We've tried some different things. In fact, we got a great picture of our son Jacob when we did radishes, and they're massive. I mean, they were massive. And that was interesting. We just find part of it's a cost measure. Annual ryegrass is less expensive than some of the other mixes that are out there. And it seems to serve the purpose. If you can let it grow a little bit in the spring, it terminates pretty easily. At one time last year, we didn't get to it a little bit. We actually did some planting green through ryegrass that was about thigh high. That was was interesting, but it was a good practice. And actually, the planter managed to get a relatively good stand. And we saw, as people have seen over time, that cover crop that had gotten pretty tall there actually became a pretty good weed barrier in between the rows. So it was an interesting one. We did not jump right back into doing it on all the acres this year, but it was an interesting way of doing that. And we do test plots, not on every acre, but close to it. If we've got a field, he'll do. Yeah, I mean, we will change things as we're going across both varieties, but also methods of applying nutrients. We tried using the strip till with some soybeans this year. So we've got another side-by-side test plot of soybeans that are strip-tilled and then planted in the narrower rows. And so just to continually collect that data so we can modify our practices. The other thing we've really found valuable, both with the cover crops as well as just the tillage methods we've used, is sometimes we get really major water events here, and we have found that the structure of the soil just allows that absorption to be significantly faster than what we've seen it on fields that have been tilled. In fact, we had a neighbor that came to us and said, you know, we had that really heavy rain a few weeks ago. What are you doing? Because yours was gone a lot faster than mine was gone. And it was really nice. A couple of years later, that farmer actually bought his first strip till machine. So we're pretty excited about that. Anytime you think, okay, we'd really like other people to recognize what we're doing and that it's valuable, when they start putting their money where their values are, then you start seeing that that begins to move. But it's a slow process. Farmers are pretty used to doing things, in many cases, the way they were did them when they were being raised on the farm.
Well, you were talking about the, you know, noticing the water infiltrate better in your soil because of some of these practices that you've implemented. Do you remember how long it took from when you started with, say, cover crops to when you actually started seeing, you know, results that you could actually kind of see and observe firsthand?
I think it happened within the first couple of years that we began to see it. Of course, we were implementing a lot of those practices kind of simultaneously. So it's hard to go back and say, okay, this was just the result of cover crops. It was probably a result of both cover crops as well as some tillage changes that we've seen, because we've certainly have noticed that that improves that infiltration rate as well. But it happens relatively soon. I mean, we don't have a really, really heavy soil. We have one set of fields about 2 miles from here that has much heavier clay soil. That's a little bit different to deal with than what we do on our sandy soil. So I think whenever you're saying, that's kind of why, you know, one size fits all doesn't work in conservation. You know, you can tell that, you know, out west, things that work for you would be really hard to implement here, and they aren't going to work very well in Kansas or Mississippi either. So that's part of the value of this whole Farmers for Soil Health program that USB is certainly involved in, is that it is personalized not only just by state, but then also even in smaller units, so that we can try and develop practices that can not only work for the environment, but also work for profitability for our farmers. So it is really important that we make that fit. So we saw some improvement pretty quickly after that. Can you tie that directly to increased yield? I don't know. We've not seen a decrease in yield. We will say that. And depending on the year and the amount of water we had that year, certainly the ability of that soil to retain that water, to get it off the surface, away from damaging the plants and getting it, and also then holding that water so that it's available. We don't use any artificial irrigation. So ours is all dry land. So we really need that rain, particularly in July and August. So that's been kind of a significant benefit for us, if we get those rains, is trying to keep that water available for those plants as long as possible.
And I know you're flying on the cover crops now. Before you did that, did you have any concerns with that, either in, I don't know, cost or like seed to soil contact, or, I mean, any concerns before, and how have those played out?
I think our one concern we had probably was coverage, but we did it primarily for a timeliness factor. We do our strip tilling in the fall, and we think that's really valuable. And so we need to get both our crop harvested and then also get our strip tilling done before we freeze, before we have snow, because we're in Michigan. So a lot of it was, what is a practice that we can move out of our wheelhouse and give to someone else? And so we decided to go with the other one. It does cost us about $35 an acre. That's what our cost was last year for both cover crops and the application of it. That does not include the termination of it. That's just what it costs us to do that. There is a significant cost, but we think it's a productive practice and worth that investment.
Do you think some of that precision in your fertilizer applications will carry over into your cover crops at some point, where you do maybe lighter versus heavier rates, or is that just not possible with flying it out with an airplane?
Really hard to do with the airplane. So, yes, it would it be nice? Yes, if you were able to get to the point where you could, you know, apply that on. And we played, you know, with the idea of, would there be a way to put cover crop on when you were strip tilling? Of course, that would you know, we'd have that gap between the time that it was there, or is there a way that you could do it? I don't think anybody's come up with one that you can put on your combine, but there are just things that you're thinking about. How could we combine these tasks together in order to do this in a timely manner? And I guess there's a possibility that you could also just hire that done, you know, on the ground. And I think as more and more people begin to implement cover crops, which hopefully we'll see through the next several years, that becomes a much more common practice, that there may be new opportunities. I know some people have talked about doing it with drones. Drones would give you the opportunity to do it much more accurately and probably change that. But the airplane, even though it looks like they're like 5 feet over your head, are really a little higher than that, although they come pretty close when they're coming in. But yeah, theirs is definitely a broadcast method. So even though the technology's there, they release it at a pretty steady rate. Any kind of change in winds or just how the plane is moving is going to make it really challenging, if not impossible, to change that based on soil tests.
And you mentioned, you know, Jacob works in sort of this biological ag tech arena. Are you all experimenting with any amendments or, you know, biological products to incorporate into your overall soil health program?
Yeah, we've been using, the products that he has, again, in test strips, so we can compare it to the ones we use the other information on. But he feels pretty strongly that there's a lot of potential with biologicals. So we'll probably continue to do that and see how that compares to our use of synthetic fertilizers. And so we have done some things with that, with the planter as we plant.
And I think earlier, did you mention filter strips? And could you maybe just give us some filter strips 101 about, you know, why you started that, how it works, that sort of thing?
We have filter strips along the edge of all of our waterways. Most of ours are 15 to 20 feet wide is what most of them are. We mow them. In some cases, you know, we drive on them to get back and forth within the field, but generally they're just there. They never get tilled. And really the purpose of them is to keep whatever nutrients you put in your field, and also to at least reduce the amount of erosion or sediment that's going into those waterways. Because of course, a lot of what gets in our waterways is nutrient runoff, but a lot of it is also just soil that's making its way in. And one, really need the soil on the field instead of in the ditches. And secondly, that sediment can cause additional problems with water quality. So we really feel strongly about the benefit of using filter strips. We've had them for many years. I don't know, 20, 25 years, long time, is when we first put those in. And probably they were pushed through the USDA pretty early on, the benefit of having filter strips. And so they've continued to do that. Since then, we've also put in some water retention structures. Our land is almost entirely tiled, subsurface tiled, partly because it used to be swamp. So that's a common practice here. But of course, when there's a lot of rain, those tiles feed into the ditches. So what these structures do is you can put gates in them or blockages in them. And so they basically hold the water back so it stays in the tile or in this tube until a lot of that water has a chance to be absorbed back into the plant matter. And once it's absorbed back in the plant matter, then you can release those out and very slowly then move that water into the waterways. But when you have a large flush of water really quickly, you're much more likely to lose nutrients at that time. So these structures do that. We don't have it in every field, but it has all of the tile lines would feed into a pipe then, or another tile that then would go right into this structure. So that's kind of how that works. And we've added a few of those over the last 6-7 years that have worked pretty well. There's also some other ones that we call saturated buffer, which is within the filter strip, and it's gravel and other material that they put in there. Again, that goal was to kind of serve as a reservoir for that water coming off the field before it then went on into the waterway. So those are both things that we've used a little bit as we've put more emphasis on what can we do to keep our water systems as clean as possible.
Well, along the lines, I know you already said that the productivity hasn't fallen off at all, but I'm wondering about how do you balance decisions related to conservation and profitability? Kind of, how do you kind of keep a delicate balance there?
Well, the one thing that's been an improvement is part of conservation is making fewer trips across the ground. So some of our savings have simply come in fuel costs as well as labor, because you're trying to make fewer trips. Yes, we purchased a new strip till machine. It wasn't new. It was used and it was expensive, but at the same time, you know, we don't use our chisel plow anymore. There's a trade-off of what are you giving up as well as what are you picking up. So we've also found that we continue to be profitable in the same way that we were before using these other practices. And that's really the point we try and get across to the farmers we talk to, is that, you know, profitability is not this one and conservation this one. I said they can be very close together. It's not like they're two ends of a spectrum. And I'm afraid that that really is the mindset with a lot of people, is if I do this, then I'm going to give up this. And what they really need to recognize is they can work in tandem with one another. And some of it isn't that I'm getting a greater yield. It's just I have fewer costs related to the tillage that I was doing prior to that.
Yeah, usually when I get a call, when a farmer's thinking of transitioning, they say, well, what am I going to give up the first 5 years? And they say, well, I don't think you have to give anything up. You can stack your tools and you can create a program like you have on your farm that helps you kind of weather through that. And just trading one thing for another, right?
Right. And there are times that, as I said, with the cover crops, that it might not work really well. So I think it's really important for people to say, you know, try this for 3 years, try this for 5 years, and then tell me what you see. Because, right, you're not going to see really great improvements in water retention, you know, 6 months after you start your practice. You're going to continue to see it, but it might not be noticeable until you've done some of these for a while. And the same thing with, you know, with cover crops. People are not necessarily going to see a tremendous change if they only do it for 1 year. And that's why, yeah, the Farmers for Soil Health is set up as a three-year program for that very reason, is begin to do it, but at the same time, set up the fee structure so that they begin to take more responsibility for that too. But I think that we can hopefully begin to move people in that direction, but it takes a long time.
Great. And actually, let's start talking about your involvement both in Michigan and on, you know, the U.S. Soybean Board. How did that get started? And maybe just talk a little bit about your experiences so far.
Well, I taught agri-science education for a little over 30 years in our local school district. And when I retired from that occupation, I was looking for something else to be involved in that would allow me to, I guess, have some influence in the agricultural world as well as to contribute what I could. And someone suggested that I apply for a position on the Michigan Soybean Board, at that time called the Michigan Soybean Promotion Committee. But I did that, and I'm just completing my ninth year on that board. About 6 years in, there was an opening on the United Soybean Board, so I put my name in for that. So I'm just completing my third year on USB. I was elected to the executive committee for USB last December, and then appointed to chair the communication and education committee, which, given my background in education, was a pretty nice fit for me. So I've just really enjoyed my participation on both of those boards. I've learned an incredible amount about soybeans. I had the basics down, but just have learned a lot. And really what's been most impressive is just the value of the checkoff and what it means, what kind of a return the farmers get on their investment into the checkoff in marketing opportunities and in research and in communication, so many different areas. That's just, I don't think most farmers have a grasp of how valuable it actually is.
Yeah, I'm curious about what are you cooking up in the Communication and Education Committee? What are the top projects you're working on?
We have a lot of different things going on, but one of the really exciting ones is we've just started kind of a campaign called I'm a Farm More. We have t-shirts and stickers and some bling that goes along with it, but there'll also be some social media and other articles that follow that. But it's really to try and help people understand that farming is so much more than just putting a seed in the ground and then disappearing and harvesting it later. And just the idea of so many skills and abilities, because the research that we've done has shown that there's a really high trust of farmers, but not as much of farming. So our hope is to pull those things together and help them recognize that farmers are soil scientists and their marketers and their mechanics. I mean, the list goes on and on. So the front of the shirt says, I'm a Farm More, and the back has a list of probably 50 different occupational areas that farmers have to be well-versed or competent in or able to hire one of those different things. So it's something that I've, you know, felt strongly about for a long time. I kind of grew up with a desire. The farm that I grew up on was just outside the city limits of Ann Arbor. So there were very, very few farm enterprises in that area, a lot of city influence. And so I learned from a pretty early age that we had a story to tell and that people were interested in that story. I started making the assumption that everybody knew what we did, and that is not the case. They don't know what we do. And when they do know, oftentimes their images of what they read in storybooks of Old MacDonald and one cow, one chicken, and one pig. So to be able to explain to them how that has changed and still balance the idea that farming is now an industry, but at the same time, as you know, 95% of the farms in the U.S. are still family-run farms. So it is still a legacy, a tradition. But at the same time, we haven't just sat back. We've employed a tremendous amount of technology, and much of that technology has been employed in order for us to farm smarter and in a way that's better for the environment.
Absolutely. Lori, this has been so great. Thank you so much. And anything else you'd want to add or emphasize to an audience of other farmers that are at varying, you know, degrees of their own soil health journey?
I would simply say that you need to talk to other farmers that are using the practices and gather information from them and start with a small area. Say, okay, I'm going to do these 20 acres or these 30 acres. And oftentimes, you can find opportunities in your area. We've often told people, how about if we just come and, you know, strip till this for you for, you know, this small area, and then you can just try it. So I think you'll find farmers that are willing to do that. If not, sometimes the local conservation districts will have tools that they will help you make available for you to use, or will help you be able to try that practice. But there are a lot of them that can be tried on a pretty small scale. And then as they get more comfortable with them, they begin to move in that direction. But we've had other mostly young farmers that have come to us and say, can I ride with you while you strip till? You know, can I see how you're using this? And we'll take the pickup and drive them alongside the tool, or else let them ride with it, or just have them look at some of the things that we're using. But it requires people that are open to seeking more information. So I guess my major message to them is don't settle. You know, be willing to look for what are new opportunities that I can use on my farm that will help me to be more profitable, but also help to ensure that the soil that I leave behind for the generations to come is as good as it possibly can be and still viable for other generations to continue farming in this area.
Absolutely. That is what we are all about here on the podcast. A great place to wrap up today's conversation. Thank you very much to Lori Isley for taking the time to be on the show. I really enjoyed learning about the many things that they're trying on their farm, from strip tillage to cover crops to the precision technology to biologicals as well. Very, very cool. Plus all the work she's, of course, doing on behalf of soybean growers with United Soybean Board and the Communication and Education Committee as well. A lot of cool stuff to cover there. Thank you again to Lori. Before we close, I do want to thank the Soy Checkoff for sponsoring this Farmers for Soil Health series of the Soil Sense podcast. This show is produced by Dr. Abby Wick, Dr. Olivia Cayouette, and myself, with support from the United Soybean Board, the University of Missouri Center for Regenerative Agriculture, and the Soil Health Institute. If you're at all interested in what soil health looks like in practice and on the farm, I highly suggest you subscribe and follow this show on your favorite podcast app and leave us a rating and review while you're there. You might also want to check out the Farmers for Soil Health website, which is at farmersforsoilhealth.com. I'll put it in the show notes as well. Until next time, stay curious, keep collaborating, and don't forget to take a minute to stop and smell the soil. Have a good one.